You're listening to Finding Your Genius Zone with Dirk Novell. With the help of successful individuals across industries, Dirk breaks down the unknown parts of every vocation while highlighting the importance of finding a career where you can leverage your natural skills, passions, and interests. Now here's your host, Dirk Novell.
Everybody, this is Dirk Novell. Welcome to my podcast. On with me is a friend of mine, Ed Cunningham. Welcome, Ed.
Hi, Dirk. How are you?
I'm good. And by the way, where are you coming from, right? Long Beach?
Long Beach, California. Oh, yeah.
Okay, cool. I was just there recently with my son. We're trying to get rid of his peanut allergies, and there's a facility down there we take him to, and it's like a four-year process. But anyway, beautiful. Cool. We had a good time. Okay, so Ed is a friend of mine. I mean, I haven't talked to Ed in a long time, but Ed is a guy that I remember. I met him in college. Ed was a football player, in terms of, in my opinion, one of the best college teams ever. And he was a big part of that. You were the center. My cousin, I think, backed you up. And Ed was really good and played in the NFL for the Cardinals, I think for the Seahawks. But one of the things Ed has done in his career, he's really kind of shifted and he's done different things and done them really well. And I think it's really good for you to kind of see his career and understand, like, careers are not one direction. You can shift and pivot. So, Ed, why don't we kind of just start in your own words, tell the audience a little bit about what you're doing, and then we'll go backwards.
So right now, my main focus is film and television producing and directing. So back when I was playing football and then I started broadcasting with ESPN and ABC, I started working off camera. I really found the off-camera work, even though I'd done a ton of on-camera stuff as quote-unquote talent, they call it, I really enjoyed the process of filming, editing, taking notes, trying to put together a story. And so since about, I would say, 2004, I've been very actively producing, mostly documentaries. I've done a couple things that have ended up in the scripted territory. We had a show that went on Fox for a little while. But mostly it's in the nonfiction space where, for me, I find it hard watching fiction. I don't read fiction. The podcasts I listen to are history podcasts. You know, I want to hear from real people and interviews. So at this point in my career, it's really a focus on documentary films. I just finished a film that will bring out hopefully this fall. And then we have another project that's coming up right behind it. So it's been the last couple of years, the pandemic shut down production. So that got difficult for a lot of us. But the last couple of years have been very busy with film production and directing. And even after this long in this career, I really enjoy the process of what we do in filmmaking. The budgets and the accounting and all that can get a little boring, but following the story, knowing what to film, knowing how to put it together, working with an editor, that's really what I enjoy about filmmaking is the edit process. It's really creative, a lot of problem solving, a lot of A/B testing, try this, try that, it didn't work. And so the production part, going out on the road and filming, can get a little tiring, but I really enjoy, once you have the stuff in the can, spending time with an editor and, you know, writing it out. A lot of times I write stuff by hand to start, and then to get into the edit room and start to look at the footage and put it together, I still find it incredibly exciting.
So I usually want to go backwards, but I want to kind of stick on this area for a second. And I'm interested to know, like, are you more interested in the process or is it the content? Like, for example, Undefeated, the story of that football team, is it telling the story that intrigues you, or is it more about just being in that environment and all the things that happen behind the scenes? Like, could you be fulfilled editing something that you're not really into?
Oh, that's a tough question. I don't know that I could spend the time it takes to do a feature length film with a subject matter that I wasn't incredibly curious about, or had my own questions about, or every time I learned something, it was new and exciting and different. I don't know that I could spend as much time. Forget about just your sort of day-to-day schedule, but just the creative energy, the focus, the keep, because that's the thing with a feature like documentary, you've got to come back to it fresh every single day. You can't come in just punching the clock, because there's just always, you have to really be sharp, I think, especially in, you know, 15, 20 years ago, documentaries were seen as educational and boring. And I've been at it long enough where I've seen the shift into, you know, these are narratively structured stories that have great music. They have great editing. They have great graphics. They move along. There's no slack in the story, in the plot. So you really have to be on top of your game. But no, you know, I've done some commercial work. I will do commercial work. We're talking to a couple of people about doing some marketing content for them. But, you know, those are usually short, 2-3 weeks. And I can stay focused enough, because then the deliverable, the thing you're delivering, is much shorter and tighter, and it's a different format than it would be as a feature film. So, but if I'm going to spend a year, 18 months, you know, this film we just finished up, which is a follow-up to The King of Kong, which was about the Donkey Kong world record, started filming in August of 2022. We wrapped in... Well, the final story piece happened this November. So, you know, we filmed a little over a year, been editing. We have, you know, sort of a creative cut of the film. Now we're starting to finish it. I mean, that's a long, long time to be hauling around a story. And if you don't like it and you're not really engaged by it, it could be a drag.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to stick on this, because this is really interesting to me. I love fiction. All right, nonfiction like you. We talked a little bit about that. I watch a lot of documentaries. The shelf life, like, let's just say you start something and it's really cool and relevant and you're passionate about it. Like, is it typically like a 2-year process, 3-year process, or does it really vary?
It all, you know, it really varies. And you know, I've done it a little bit differently than the traditional roadmap, which would be, build up your credibility, get some credits under your belt, and then go to start work for studios or networks or whatever. I've always, you know, we've done some work for hire stuff where we're working for other people, but for the most part, we've done independently financed films. Either we finance them, or we have friends, you know, that we know who have the wherewithal to finance them, put up the money. And so it sort of depends on the project. I've had the project right over my right shoulder there, Finders Keepers. That was a 7-year process to make that film. Part of it was real life was happening and nothing was happening for a long time that was, you know, moving the story along, the central story. So we just kind of had to wait. But then I've also worked on, we did a film about teenage magicians, and we got really lucky on that one, because about 2 months into filming, we ended up at this event where all of these great teenage magicians were competing, and we ended up filming the end of the film 2 months in. And then we went back and just reconstructed the stories to get those kids in that room. So that one actually went, I mean, I think we had that film done in probably 10 or 12 months, which was the fastest that I've had it done. And a lot of it is our documentaries for them. All of them have followed someone in real life. So when you have that real time element, you know, you have things, you're following them for, you know, they'll have something that they're going to do. They have a lawsuit coming and you're going to make a film about this lawsuit and they're fighting the state or whatever, you know, if it's like an issues doc. So you have this thing out there that's a major plot point, so to speak, in that person's life. But we haven't done historical ones where you just go back, you have archival footage, you lay it out, you know what the story is, you go interview some people that are experts, and then you can kind of chronologically lay it down. When you follow real life, you always have that risk of, you know, you mentioned Undefeated. One of the reasons we filmed, it's called Manassas High School in North Memphis. And the reason the directors of that film wanted to film there was the football team was going to be really good for the first time in sort of the school's history. They like made the playoffs the year before. They were turning all their best players. They had some college prospects on their team. And so we get all the money together and the filmmakers fly down there and the team lost their very first game of the season. And you know, you're sitting there going, well, we got three people living in Memphis filming this thing. how's it going to turn out? Now, luckily, the team turned around. They won a bunch straight. They went to the playoffs. It ended up being a really fulfilling season to follow. But when you're following real life, it's very difficult. As a matter of fact, we've pitched projects to ESPN, Netflix. We've pitched projects to some of those people that have a real life element, and they won't do it because they're afraid. Hey, if we start filming, what if nothing happens?
Yeah.
You know, something that's already happened, you know, like Woodstock, you know what happened at Woodstock, and it's fascinating. If you get the right footage, it's going to be great. But when you're following real life, it can be pretty risky.
You know, I've never thought about, I mean, this is really interesting because my wife and I call us boring, but we love to sit and watch documentaries or movies, and that's kind of our happy time. But I never really thought about, am I watching something that's already happened, or am I watching something in the works, like the before, the during, and the after? I'm kind of interested in, you know, if people are watching and they're fascinated by what you do, I guess a couple of things, you can answer any of the questions you want, but like, when people talk about Ed Cunningham and like, let's have Ed do this, like, what are the skill sets? Like, because you have such a diverse background. You were this really good football player. You were really good on camera, you know, when you were talking about college football. And now you're kind of in this really creative world, which probably there's a lot of other skill sets that we're not aware of. But like, what is it about Ed that makes you good at what you do? Like, is it knowing what stories will resonate, or is it the organization? I mean, I'm curious, what makes an editor a quality editor?
Well, for, you know, it's interesting.
Or producer, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah. I used to edit. I'm going to have to learn again. AI is forcing me to relearn editing, actually, believe it or not. But I think there's a couple of things. You know, I played college late 80s, early 90s. The first thing I produced was in 1991. I made a video about our national championship team. And then I started working in radio as a radio host in 93. Got my first on-camera job covering college football, I think in 95 or 96. And worked up until I left ESPN in 2017. So just the thousands upon thousands of repetitions of, especially in sports, you know, when you're covering a college football game, there's 30 or 40 guys on each team that you need to know something about. You need to just know how they're playing. Are they injured? Where are they from? Is there a cool story about how they overcame an injury and, you know, or some personal hardship? And I think because of working with, and it was really fortunate early on in my career in radio and television, I worked with really, really good producers and directors, people who just knew what they were doing. They knew what was going to be interesting. They knew, you know, in the course of a broadcast, hey, remember that story? We've got this graphic about this kid. You know, I worked with people who just from experience, talent, and just repetitions, really knew what stories were going to resonate. And then, you know, that transfers over to my filmmaking. If I read an article, if I see an interview, if I hear something, I just almost have this additional sense of, you know, this is interesting. There's something that's relatable here. It's quirky, it's different, it's meaningful. You know, the current film that we're finishing up right now is about a guy who had a lifelong dream to be a singer-songwriter, right? Very relatable. All of us have sort of, oh, I want to write the great novel, or I want to become a painter, or, you know, whatever that is. So it had a very relatable element to it. But I think the number of stories that I've told, especially in live TV, you know, we'd cover a game on a Saturday afternoon, and there were times we were on air for 4 hours, and you've got to fill that airtime. If it's a good competitive game, the game is the story, but you know, you'd have a game that'd be 52 to 10 in the fourth quarter. And what you're really, you know, that's when you really had to work as a broadcaster, look at, you know, pulling out your notes and, Hey, give me a shot of number 37. I've got a good story on him, just to keep, because there is an audience there, even though people tune out, the families are watching, people from the university are watching. So now you're sort of talking to a home audience. But I think just that number of repetitions and all of that have really sharpen my sword to, like, you know, if you show me a barrel of stories, I'm going to stab the right one, just because I've done it so many times over the years.
Yeah. I mean, I keep thinking, wow, what a range. And I know you're humble, and I'm just going to say, like, the range of skills that you have, you know, I've known a lot of athletes that have played, but then you went into the TV world, and you know, I want to talk a little bit about that, because I find it part of, like, my podcast is about being brave enough to go down the road, maybe not play it safe or run the race that everybody run, you know, becoming a whatever, a lawyer or a doctor or a CPA. You know, you've done some very unique, different careers, and you've done a great job as a commentator. I know you got out because of some of your, you can articulate it yourself, but, you know, the concussions and the dangerous things that were going on, I'll let you kind of articulate that. But you were brave enough to kind of pivot and just do a 180. And I think that's brave. I don't think a lot of people do that. I guess, can you kind of take us back a little bit? I mean, here you were on a, you were going down a road. You could have probably been one of the main guys if you stuck with it. And you probably were at the time, but the future was bright, and then you decided to kind of leave that industry. Can you tell us a little bit about why?
Yeah, I had broadcast football on TV every year since, I think, 96 or 97. So 2017 comes along. I'm working at ESPN, ABC, and I'm in one of the best chairs. You know, we're calling big games every Saturday. I worked with a really incredible team. Mike Patrick was the play-by-play guy that I worked with last, who was just, I mean, incredible partner, just so good at his job and so much fun to be around. And I really enjoyed, when I worked at ESPN and ABC, I had the luxury of working with incredibly talented, good people. I mean, you're on the road and you're having to, like, eat dinner at 10 o'clock at night to get, you know, you're traveling, everyone's rushing the airport, trying to get home. And so it's pretty tight quarters, and I really enjoyed working there. But what I was really having an issue with, and it's, I had it since I was a college football player, was, here's this incredibly dangerous sport. You know, there's no more, see no evil, evil, hear no evil. This is a dangerous sport. And, you know, we have to keep that in context. There's a lot of dangerous sports, skateboarding, youth girls soccer has a lot of concussions. You know, there's a lot of sports where we have to grow as a society and learn, and football has gotten much safer. You know, the statistics in the NFL, concussions are down 25 or 30%. They're definitely getting better at the college level. High school level can be a little concerning because of the amount of professionals it takes to be safe, but the sport has gotten safer. But at that time in 2017, couple of things were happening. One, I was getting busier as a producer. You know, I had this on-air job, which was great, but from the middle of August until January, you know, there was 4 days a week where I was on the road. And even when I was home, I was on conference calls and doing interviews and prepping to go on the road. And so it was really taken away from my family. It was taken away from really, my passion is film, making movies. And so I got to a place where I said, okay, how long do I want to keep doing this? And then two things happened. One was, I could no longer square being a professional working at a major multi-billion dollar corporation covering kids who were not being paid for their labor. And at the time, the name, image, and likeness issue had not been settled by the Supreme Court. So kids weren't making any money. They were getting their scholarship and, like, a living expense they got. And so it was hard for me to square, okay, here I am sitting up literally in this lofty tower. We're sitting up above this field and in sometimes criticizing these kids. And they are kids. You know, these are 18, 19, 20. And then they become young adults. But, you know, when they get to college, they're kids. And I couldn't square them really putting everything on the line while the rest of us, the coaches, the announcers, the executives, the people who ran the athletic department, are all making into the six figures and more, while these guys aren't being paid at all for what they're doing, which is dangerous. And then the sort of final nail in the coffin and why I chose to leave was, I was having this, just ethically, I was having an issue. And then ESPN laid off 100 of my colleagues, and some guys I worked with got laid off, people who really love the job and were really good at the job. And I just, you know, it's funny. I've worked in a garage my whole life. I'm in my producing garage, and right out there is where I park. And I remember I came home, I went and got a coffee, and I came home and I started getting texts about the layoff. And I sat in my car out there in my parking space for probably 2 hours. Just, what am I going to do? I called people I'm close to. And a couple hours later, I resigned from ESPN. And it's hard to put into context how big a deal that was. I mean, I had one of the, if you're into sports media, I had one of the best jobs going. I really did. You know, I had a great position. I got great assignments. I worked with a great team. My bosses appreciated what I did. I got good feedback. But when I sat there, those two ethical things, one, these kids aren't being paid and they should be. And two, ESPN's cutting people back and they're cutting people that really want this job. And so I figured, you know, if there's people who want this job right now and I'm feeling this way, I should probably step aside. And it was hard. It was a very hard decision. I don't miss the travel. I don't miss the, you know, it has made things easier to raise a family and be around, especially in the fall. You know, there's so much that goes on with school. But I really do miss live TV. I really miss working with great people who were just total professionals, fun to be around, enjoyable folks. And I do miss that countdown from 5 to 0 when the light comes on and you're on TV, man, and you got to roll. So I miss that. But yeah, it was a really difficult decision. But those two things, the layoffs and the ethical issue I had with these kids playing such a difficult, dangerous sport and not being paid.
So let me make sure I understand this, because I've always thought it was more about the danger of concussions and not wanting to be part of that. Am I mistaken?
No, that was a big part of it. But the point, the flip was, they're doing this thing that's completely dangerous and we know it, and they can be concussed, they have lifelong issues, and they're also not being paid for what they're doing when everybody else in the business is throwing around tens and millions and hundreds of millions of dollars for media rights and apparel sponsorships. So it was the balance of that these kids were risking themselves. And there's no denying that. We can't, you know, you can no longer say that we don't know that. But no, it was the balance of that and them not being compensated for what they were doing.
And I don't want to maybe get too far down the rabbit hole on the NIL, but I am curious, because I had a conversation today with a friend of mine. Are the way they're doing it now, is this like, if you could reverse the clock, like, would this have satisfied you back in the day, like the way athletes are getting paid, or are they far away from where it should be? I mean,
it's interesting. I hadn't really done that test, that thought experiment. If NIL was being paid back then, would I have left? I don't know. I was a little burnt out too. I'd been doing it for a long time. That was a factor. So maybe still, but to your question about, you know, is it there? It's not even close, because right now, the way that the athletes are being compensated is by outside companies unrelated to the university, unrelated to the media deal, unrelated to ticket sales, unrelated to jersey sales, unrelated to any of that. They're left to go out on their own or with the so-called collective, which is the, you know, sort of fundraising arm for these schools now. But that's all separate from the university. That cannot come from any of the money that goes to the university. And the biggest issue, the biggest amount of money out there is the media rights. You know, these schools are still taking 100% of the media money, and there is no, the Supreme Court, when Justice Kavanaugh said, you can no longer hide behind this, like, these are not employees, it really started to open up this discussion. And Jim Harbaugh, the coach of Michigan before he left to go to San Diego. And here, that's why a lot of guys are bouncing out of college football, is it's become this ridiculous world where these outside groups are controlling the money. And Jim Harbaugh was very, very adamant. We've got to pay these guys. They've got to get a piece of these media revenues. they, for this to work, there has to be a collective bargaining agreement. And there's multiple lawsuits that are still winding their way through the courts that are going to force that. The NCAA is running from it. The institutions are running from it. Nobody wants to see that because you're going to take 30, 40, 50% of your revenue and it's going to have to go to the athletes. And I'm telling you, Dirk, no one wants to have that conversation. They want to run from that as long as they can. And because the players aren't organized or in a union or otherwise, they've tried, you know, they've put together these associations that are trying to help them, but there is no union really to take up their cause. But until that happens, college sports and specifically college football, because it's the highest earning sport, they're going to be in a world of flux until that gets settled.
You know, I know you are no longer doing a podcast, but I'm just listening to you and thinking, God, you'd be so good talking about these topics, you know, and kind of cutting through all the noise. I don't know. I think you should consider it getting back. I know you're busy.
I have considered it. And some of it is around sort of the more top, not sort of drilling down, but mean more sort of what's going on with the business side, because it's really shocking to me. In the current sports media culture, especially around college sports, it's almost like the media is afraid to bring up collective bargaining. It's like this sort of bugaboo of, oh, if this happens, it's all going to go sideways. And, you know, God forbid, you know, the coaches, I mean, there's coaches making $10 million a year now to coach college football. You know, they could make six and four could go back to the kitty for the kids and to support the other programs. But it's really interesting how I appreciate that. And it's something I've considered. But it really is interesting. It's almost, you know, remember companies like ESPN and Fox and NBC and now Amazon, they have a vested interest in their live sports rights. So how much are they going to really sort of poke the bear, you know, especially with the NFL or someone like that to sort of really question the system? But it is fascinating right now how very few people in the sports media world, I think, have fully grasped the size of this. And they think like, oh, NIL is here. The players are being paid. And no, they're out having to hustle deals at car dealerships to get $500 for an appearance. They're out, you know, we all read about Caitlin Clark and, you know, the top quarterback at USC, what he got paid. Those are 1%. The rest are out there hustling and not making much money at all, if at all. And I don't think there's any way to escape the fact that these kids need to be paid. And it's really, people are sort of running from it.
So on the sports commentary career that you had, I want to leave that chapter. But before I do, I want to, like, people, I think a lot of times people have voices in their head when they're thinking about what they want to do. And I don't know, I hate to use the word sexy, but that seems like a very fun, sexy job. If you love sports, you're talking. And there's probably a lot about that career that people don't know. Is there one or two things that, like, if you had a child that's like, hey, Dad, I want to follow in your footsteps, what would you, I don't, maybe the word is warn them on, like, but what probably don't they know about that career that they should know before they spend the time to pursue it?
Yeah, it's one of the regular calls I get. Hey, my son's thinking about getting into sports media, or, you know, is working at a station. And the future is confusing because production is getting smaller. So, you know, if you watch an NFL game, you know, there's probably 60 or 70 people there working to cover the game, from camera people to audio to interns. You know, there's a big, big crew there. Now, that's on the top games, right? And it takes a while to get a job on one of those crews. But the lower part, you know, there's games all over the country now. I mean, my kids the other day on YouTube were watching a Little League baseball game that was fully announced, had two cameras. I mean, it was like kind of mind blowing. But understand that just like any career, usually when you start out in those jobs, they're pretty low paying. So you're going to hustle a lot and not make a lot of money to start. And so what I would say about getting into sports production is be ready for a little bit of a haul of not making a bunch of money, having to share some hotel rooms and, you know, jump in a car to go from New York to Pennsylvania for a Penn State game, you know, whatever has to happen to start your career. But I would, it's not even, I mean, the opposite of a warning, working in sports television is awesome. It's a really, really cool, fun, engaging, exciting job. It's live television. It's remote location. So you're going to a new place. You're learning about that place. You're setting up. And what's nice about the profession, you know, unlike maybe a lot of professions, nobody cares where you went to school. Nobody cares if you went to college. All they care about is, are you a good person? Are you good at your job? Do you hustle? Do you bring more to the table than you ask for? And when the lights go on for live TV, can you do your job? And that's one of the, you know, sort of the meritocracy of live television that I loved. I mean, unless someone brought up, like, you know, if they went to Clemson and Clemson's playing a big game, they might wear their Clemson. You just never knew. It never came up. Oh, where'd you go to college? What did you study? You know, I mean, a lot of the people I worked with over the years, they were studying like philosophy, and they saw a note at the athletic department saying, hey, looking for runners for this weekend's game for ABC. And they went and got like $75 for the day to literally run errands, right? And then they met the director, they met a producer, you know, they got in touch with them. And next thing you know, they have this 20 or 30 year career in live sports television. So it's an incredible career. It does take a while to get up the totem pole to like making a good living and, you know, being able to take care of a family and all that. But, you know, if you're in your early 20s and you're going to hustle for any job, I would highly encourage looking at sports television, live sports television. It's a really exciting, fun, and can be a prosperous career if, you know, you get in the right track and you work for the right networks.
I never asked, I mean, I'm not asking what you made, Ed, but like the compensation, is that like a salary-based job when you're in front of the camera and you're, you know, either doing the play-by-play or the color? Okay. So is there
So most of the crew, so off camera, most of the crew on those shows are 1099 work for hire people. And, you know, that can be a real grind, right? When's my next job coming? I was lucky enough to be a salaried employee. Most of the top people, producers and directors, are salaried for the network. But below that, it can be a real hustle to be a 1099, you know, day player, basically getting a day rate. But once you work your way up, you know, it's a pretty good day rate. And if you're good at your job and you're good to be around and you help clean up and you're there till everything's done, you're going to keep getting phone calls because the producers and directors in live TV, they just don't want to have to worry about you and your job. They want you to do it and you to do it well. As far as on camera, you know, that's a long shot for anybody to get on camera work. You know, for an analyst or what I did, which was the color analyst, you have to have either played or coached the sport just so you have a deep understanding of it. But as far as a play-by-play announcer or a host or something, that's a craft. That's something you have to work at, get repetitions. Calling a game is really a fine art. And I know every good play-by-play announcer I ever worked with talked about when they were a kid having a tape recorder and literally recording themselves calling a game and listening back to it. Like Eli Gold, who called Alabama football for years, was a partner of mine. He grew up in New York City and he used to go to Islanders game and literally sit up in the rafters with a recorder and call the action of the hockey game. That's when he's like 12 years old, right?
Yeah.
So there's got to be a real passion and a real drive. And then the final thing I'll say, Dirk, that's really important is, you know, and people in big media. So, you know, if you're working at Fox or NBC or whatever, you know, that's a job that doesn't really require you to be too entrepreneurial. But if you want to be on camera and you want to, in this modern culture, if you want to have a voice and a name, I highly recommend social media and digital media and getting yourself out there. There's no way to sort of put into context if you have a couple hundred thousand followers or subscribers on YouTube, on your channel or whatever. It's really hard to, that's a huge value. So I think for younger people, if you want to be a personality, if you want to be on camera, maybe you want to be an opinion-based guy or something like that, get on YouTube, get on X, get out there and build a following. Because once you have a following, it's like being your own network. You can put out your own stuff. You can monetize your own stuff. So I wouldn't, it's almost like there's a couple of paths to take. But I think digital and social media and building an audience, if you have the wherewithal and you have the talent to do that, it can be invaluable.
That's really good advice. I'll leave it by saying, I remember watching you, and I really gravitate towards people who have played the game and the credibility of knowing what it's like to get hit by an all-world linebacker or whatever. But I go back to your range of skill set. I know you, you're very likable, you're funny, you can read a room, you're not just some stereotypical football player. You had a talent at that, and I don't think you can teach that. And so I think maybe, I don't mean to ramble on this, but one of the things that you did that I think stood out is just you brought people in, you had this personality, I wanted to hear what you had to say next. So you were very good at what you did. And I know you're very good at what you do now. Going back a little bit further, you talked about your buddy from New York that did the Alabama games. Was it Elliot or Ellie?
Eli Gold, yeah.
Eli. So yeah. You made a comment, and I've heard that before about little kids, what you do when you're young. Can you go back in time and you went to high school in DC. Were there signs back then? I know that you were an athlete and you were going to go play college ball, but were there things that you can point to that you're this makes sense? Were you doing movies back in high school, documentaries?
No, there was a couple of things that came together. I think it was more in college for me. A couple of things that happened. One was I took a public speaking course as an elective. I was a business management major. And I wish I could remember the professor's name, young guy, small class, 12 people. And we had to give a speech in front of the class every week. You had to present and give a speech. Now, he worked on what's your structure, what's your argument. And that class was, I always had sort of a gift for gab and could, have opinions and sort of do that. But that class, that public speaking course, really set for me, what preparation was. You can't just get up and wing a 7-minute speech on deforestation in the Northwest. We'd get sort of these, you just give topics. So you have to give a speech on this. You didn't always get to choose your topic. So you'd have to go do the research. You have to formulate what you're saying. And the whole thing was, make a convincing argument. So that was first. And then it was the explosion of cable TV and big media was, sort of the mid 80s into the early 90s when I was in college. And because at the University of Washington, we were good and we were a top 5 team, there was just media around all the time, camera guys and interviews. And the biggest thing I think that happened for me in my career was I started doing radio on KISW, which was a rock radio station. And I became a regular guest. And I remember I got to go in because we were having a good season and they wanted to sort of, tie into what we were doing. And I remember I went into the studio for a morning show. I got there 5 a.m., right? And they go on the air at 5:30. And the buzz in the room of when they were getting ready and the amount of material that they had to prepare to do a 3.5-hour live broadcast, it was so exciting. It was just oh, wait, guys don't go on the radio and just blab. They're not just, windbags. They're actually prepared. And actually, the first time I did a whole 3.5-hour show on KSW with the host.
Who was the host?
It was, Spike on Sports, Spike O'Neill, who's still a dear friend, was the guy who brought me in, but it was Bob Rivers. It was Twisted Radio. Bob Rivers is, legendary. broadcaster, and I learned so much from those guys. But I think that, you know, understanding public speaking and how to break through and say things that are meaningful and have thought and consideration behind them, I think I got from that. And then with live radio, one thing I learned is you prepare, and then you got to let it go. Because once you go live, if you're thinking or you're looking at your notes, you're going to stumble. But it's all that preparation. So I got very fortunate. It was more in college, I think, that those two things, the public speaking course and then working and being able to, you know, go in and be a part of that morning radio show. It just showed me that, you know, this you have to put in real work to tell stories, to do it properly, to interview people properly. I mean, they did these ridiculous on this radio show. They do these ridiculous bits. My buddy, Spike O'Neill, he could do all these voices, right? So he'd go in the other room and call in, but they'd have to write out very specifically, what are the questions? What are the follow-ups? Really incredible to watch those guys work. And here I was 22, 23 years old, wondering, you know, at the time, I mean, I thought I could play in the NFL, but I didn't know if I could. So there was this part of me that's like, oh, wait a minute. This looks like it could be a pretty good career.
Speaking of football, I just want to ask you, like, did you love playing? I mean, or was it something that you just did because you were good at it? Or did you lose the passion? Or did you?
Yeah, the NFL beat it out of me, dude. I mean, I loved college football. I loved, you know, the competition, the camaraderie. We had, you know, we won a bunch of games my last few years. We won a national championship. I liked the guys I played with. I liked the guys I played for. Unfortunately, when I got to the NFL, you have no control over where you're going. And I went to a pretty bad organization at the time. And, you know, I remember my senior year at Washington, we were 12-0. We won 12 and lost no games. My rookie year in the NFL, we were 4-12. So I lost as many games in my rookie year as I had won the year before. And, you know, I still look back on my five, because I played 5 years in the NFL. And I was, you know, I was pretty happy I got to leave on my own. You know, I was with the Seahawks. They wanted me back, and I was just sort of done. And I remember the day I left, and I thought, how the hell did I just do that? How did I play for 5 years? Because it is such a grind, physically, mentally. You know, if you had two of the 5 years I played in the NFL, I completely hated the coach I was playing for, thought he was an idiot, as the rest of the team did. And it's just hard to play a sport that or compete at something that's that sort of high stress and not have good coaching is pretty tough to take. So the NFL, you know, people call it the no fun league, but when you play in it, you know, there's a lot of guys that don't get to go play for a great organization and don't get great coaching. You know, you think it would be the top of the heap, but it's not always that way. And so the NFL, it really dragged it out of me. It was a pretty rough slog.
Well, one more question based on your experience is, you know, with your kids or your friends or whatever, when you look back, is there one player that kind of came into your life that you played against or with that just kind of stood out? Like, I mean, when you were at a Husky, I mean, that was a very, very good team. And again, I think one of the best teams I've ever, well, college teams you'll ever see, in my opinion. And I know I'm biased, but I mean, you played with some talent. And then even on a team like in Arizona, I think, I mean, even when you're 4-12, there's still really, really talented players that you're playing with. Is there one in particular or a couple that you like, this guy was different?
Yeah, in college, it was a guy named Steve Entman. Steve was a year behind me in school. He was a defensive lineman. He ended up winning the Outland and Lombardi trophies, which are for top linemen in college football. He was a guy who, freakish athlete, where he was big and fast and strong and, you know, flexible, and just he had all the tools physically to be good, but he had a different level of competitor in him. And, you know, I look at the team that I played on that we won the national championship. We had, I mean, I don't know, 30 guys from that team played in the NFL from the first and second string. I mean, we had a ton of guys that were top level players, but Steve stood out. Not only was he, you know, probably our best just flat player, he was our most competitive. And I've always, you know, I think that's probably true of companies. If your top people are your best people, things usually fall in line behind that. If they're working hard, they're focused, and Steve was, he was a fun guy. He was a good teammate. He was good to be around. But here was a guy with all this ability, and he would play and compete harder than all of us. And it was like just us trying to keep up with what he was doing. And then, you know, I had, again, in college, my first start ever was against Junior Seau, which, you know, unfortunately, Junior took his own life, which, you know, we were talking about earlier with brain injuries. But my very first taste of college football was at the Coliseum against Junior Seau. And I was the highlight reel when he was drafted by San Diego because he just ran over me just about every play. So I had played against guys like that. But Steve was a guy who, to this day, even after playing in the NFL, he was the best teammate combo of player, competitor, good guy, fun to be around. He's the best teammate I ever had.
He was special. The thing when I think of Steve, like I grew up playing against a guy named Mike Lustig.
Yeah.
And Mike, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, was supposed to be the guy. And then I don't know if Steve was really that known. And then I think Steve kind of took over that role. And it's interesting peaking, you know, like in terms of sports. I knew a lot of my brother played in college and backed up Brent Jones. And Brent was good in college, but he really got good at, in the 49ers. But it's interesting the timing of peaking, you know. Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's not, you know, you're not the best player in college. Maybe it's the end of college, or maybe, I don't know. But
yeah, you see that, you know, because I went through it, as you go up that pyramid from high school into college, into the pros, the level of intensity goes up in a way, especially in football, that some guys just can't hang with it. And it's okay. I mean, I saw guys come from, you know, every year we'd have a new draft group come through, and there'd be two or three guys on the first day of full pads, full hitting, that you would just say, man, they're not going to make it. They're not made for this. And I am not putting those people down, because it is a freaking grind. Like, there's some of them, I'm like, we had one guy from the University of Kentucky. We were 2 weeks in. Middle of practice, he just started taking off his equipment, literally taking off his equipment, walking on the field. Coach, like, where are you going? He goes, I quit. This sucks. I don't want to do this. This is too hard. And I remember thinking, God, I wish I could do that, you know? And so that's, I think, what happens, you know. I don't know, even know it's early peaking. It's just you get at every level you go up, yeah, it's more and more intense. Guys are better and better. There's a little bit of a edge to it. You know, guys get a little feisty. Yeah. And I think for some people, it's like, you know, I don't want to do this. And I got to tell you, I'm okay with that, because it's a grind.
No, I applaud you for what you did. As we wind this podcast down, I kind of want to go back to where we started and just ask you a couple questions as we end this. One of the things, like, I think it's fascinating what you do. And I'm curious, like when people are choosing a career, I want to talk about like freedom and compensation, and can you enjoy your family, or are you always tied, you know, can you go on vacation and be relaxed? But in terms of political stuff, like if you wanted to take on a topic that was very political, like I'm just going to throw out, let's say you wanted to take on maybe vaccinations aren't so safe, or maybe, you know, there's another side to that story or whatever. And I'm not trying to get deep on this topic, but are you worried about taking on certain issues or stories that could blow you up? Or like, do you consider before you get into something, like, will this play out, or will Big Pharma just blow me away, or will I be done? Does that cross your mind?
Yeah, it does. I mean, for me, I am not drawn as a filmmaker. I'm not really drawn to political issues. I'm not really drawn to, what are called issues docs. Undefeated, which won an Academy Award, was about a black high school football team, right? And I think there's a way that you could tell that story that really dives into race relations and inequality and those things. But even in that story, I think the directors did a fantastic job of letting the kids' lives speak for themselves so that they weren't saying, oh, this is bad. These kids don't have enough. This is a terrible neighborhood they're growing up in. They have no instead of saying that, they just lived with these kids, filmed it, and then showed it. But even that film, I remember there was some criticism about the film because it didn't talk about race enough. And it was really fascinating because if you watch the movie, you know, it's clear these are Black kids in a Black neighborhood that is broken. And it's like, how much more do you need to talk about race rather than just showing how awful it is where these kids and you know, kids are born victims of where they're born. They don't, you know, they don't get to choose to live in Beverly Hills or North Memphis, Tennessee. That's where they're born. But it was interesting that people sort of took a shot at it, that it wasn't more overtly tackling the race issues. But, you know, I would never want to do that film any differently. I would never want the filmmakers to dive into that. But I've never been drawn to that. But there is clearly in our business, you have to, you know, the people who really risk themselves are those who are out there telling issues, stories, and getting access to people that might be dangerous. For me, I'm a little more on the pop culture side when I pick our topics. I'd like them to be a little more broad.
Yeah.
But no, I don't have to deal with that much just because it's just not my bag.
I get it. One of my good friends is close with Jim Caviezel, and obviously he came out with a very powerful movie about the topic of human trafficking. And in my mind, I sometimes think about those types of documentaries or those types of stories, and there's always going to be probably a pushback somewhere politically. And I don't know that world. So that was kind of the intent of my question.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll ask this question too. If someone is interested in what you're doing, I know it's a lot of work. I know it's a lot of time. What don't they know about it? Like, what do you want to, like, again, take your son or you have a daughter and they want to be a producer and do what you're doing. What do you want to warn them about, like, that maybe they don't know?
You have to put the work in to learn how to. Here's what I would say. If you want to be a filmmaker, you have to learn it all. You have to learn how to shoot. You have to learn how to edit. You have to learn how to mic somebody, how to capture sound. You have to learn how to work in an edit software, which is, you know, it's getting a little easier. We used AI on this last project to help with our transcriptions and some of the editing where we could sort things a little easier. So it's like, you know, there's this new part of the business that's starting. But I think, you know, it's almost like working at a company, you know, like Apple or something. You know, the best executives are usually the ones who work their way up doing a bunch of different stuff in the company. You know, because they get it. They've been there. They can be more compassionate with people with what they're doing or understanding. But I think for filmmaking, it is a big, broad thing, right? You have to finance the thing. You have to make a budget. You have to schedule people. You have to go shoot. You have to learn how to interview if you're doing documentaries. You have to learn to work with actors if you're doing scripted. You have to learn how to do post-production. You have to learn how to work with a composer. You have to learn how to finish a film legally. You know, we got to license the music. We got to license footage, whatever all that is. And now for me, it's actually an exciting time because with this current film, we're going to do a little more direct to consumer marketing than we've ever done with a film. And that's exciting for me because that's a whole new thing. My, you know, filmmaking is usually business to business sales. We make something, we sell it to Netflix or whatever. Now, because the business is changing so much, we're going to roll out a more business to consumer plan with this film. It has, you know, we have a little built-in audience. So that's really exciting for me. But what I would tell people is you've got to learn it all. You really have to learn it all. I don't know that you can just say, oh, I'm a film producer because you did what? Because a producer develops material. The producer chases things down. You go get the rights for things. You get people to agree to be interviewed. Like, there's so many different things you have to do. But I would say do it often. Make short films. Like, the repetition part of our business is really important. But my advice would be do it all. Go start helping a friend. If they're making a movie, go help hold the boom mic while they're shooting a scene. Just do it all. Be on sets. Be around cameras. And also learn how to work material. Learn how to edit. That's really, if I were giving anybody advice about being a filmmaker, learn how to edit. It is the most important thing to know for many reasons. One of the biggest being, then you know what to go shoot. If you know how to edit, you can say, okay, what do I need to make this scene? All right, we're doing a piano scene. So I need pictures of their hands playing piano. He taps his foot when he plays. Let me shoot his foot tapping. Because you need all these little pieces to then tell the story and cut to something that is interesting and moves the story along. But I would say the number one thing is to learn how to edit.
I love it. I mean, I was going to ask you advice. That's advice for that career. In general, it just, if someone's watching and they're struggling with what they want to do and for whatever reason, do you have any just career advice
and this sort of happened by accident. You have to really enjoy the sort of base of what you're doing. You know, it's like if you're going to be an accountant and, you know, maybe you do love numbers, maybe that's your love, but maybe it's because you want to help people and help them save some money and make. I think you have to find that thing that allows you, because, you know, some jobs are boring. Let's just be honest, right? And there's parts of filmmaking that are boring. You know, I mean, you know, I've had days where we'd shoot for an hour and then sit around all day and do nothing because we were done with what we needed. So I think it's a way to find some passion in what you're doing, find a reason to do what you're doing, because, you know, there can be long days. And if you don't love it, you don't enjoy it, and it doesn't work for you. And it can be any job. You know, I have friends who have jobs who the reason they love it is because they love their coworkers. They have great friendships. They've built, you know, lifelong friends with the people they work with. And they may not really enjoy their day job, but they like the people they're with. They like the company they work for. So there's different ways to find it. But for me, I've been really fortunate that I really enjoy what I do. So the boring parts, you just do them because they're a part of the job.
If this is your last chapter in terms of a career, are you content? Is there something else? Yep.
Well, you know, it's changing, Dirk. The you know, I mentioned we're going to do a little more business to consumer marketing on this next film. I will grow as an entrepreneur around film, where the old model of I'm a filmmaker, I get hired by other people to go out and do this. Those days are not, they're not gone, but it's really difficult to make that a career now. So for me, it's okay. I know content. I know stories. I know what resonates with people. I know how to hook people. What else could I do with that? And part of that is starting to sell direct to consumer with merchandise, collectibles. We're going to sell DVDs of this new film, which is a small market, but it's a niche market that's strong. Yeah. So I'm really pushing myself to grow as an entrepreneur in the, you know, TV and film space, where I can figure out other ways to monetize and grow the business away from just, okay, I made a movie, now what, right? And that's been the hardest thing, I think, over the last couple of years, is as the business has changed and shifted so much, is, all right, what's the business model now? And to me, it's being more scrappy, being more entrepreneurial, going out and trying to hustle my films to be shown in theaters and, you know, maybe selling some t-shirts or whatever that business model is. That's the next step for me, is becoming a little more adept at direct to consumer and what modern media is. You know, it's like what we were talking about earlier with kids being able to go on YouTube and, you know, they can just become a commentator. I mean, my kids watch a couple of baseball commentators on YouTube that are in their 20s and they're good. They play highlights, they have funny comments, and they got 3 million subscribers, you know? Yeah. But so I sort of feel like a dinosaur in that way, but I'm not old enough to learn it. And that's what excites me, is becoming more entrepreneurial around film.
I love it. Yeah, no, I'm embarrassed. My son asked me, how many people are subscribed to you? And like, my goal is to get to 100. Yeah. So I have a body of work, and then I want to take the content to colleges, universities, and see how I can kind of get this in front of people at that age when they're trying to figure out what they want to do. I know you got a baseball game to go to. My last question, is there a story out there that you like, is there a dream story that you want to tackle? That, you know, someday, like, God, if I could do a film on this, or
There's two. And it's so dangerous to talk about like future projects, because I always feel like it can jinx it. I'm really interested in a story, and I won't go into the specifics. Do you remember the old USFL back in the 80s? And I know, you know, it was around on Fox just recently. That was an incredibly important league as far as professional football in America. So I feel like there's a, and this would be a scripted film, which I haven't done as a director, but that would be something I want to do. There's a really great story in the old USFL that I'll tease it a little bit. It does involve Donald Trump, because he was one of the owners, and that's part of the story I want to tell is what transpired with that. And I think it's a fascinating story. And then, you know, this is one of the dangers of our business. I'm literally just finishing up a film. We just got the edit right. It's going into color correction and sound editing right now. But in growing up, two things were going on. Our high school football team was becoming sort of a powerhouse. And we had this incredibly scary, unbelievable, inhuman noise that was coming out of the forest near my house that ended up being called the Mount Vernon Monster. And it's a fascinating story. I mean, the Parks Department put up a helicopter. It was crazy. I lived a couple of blocks from this forest, and it was all part of George Washington's plantation. So there's this really incredible, I don't know how to crack it yet. I don't know how to tie my, because my high school football coach was really an incredible guy, and unfortunately has passed, but was very near and dear to me. But it was his first year as the head coach at our high school when that was going on. And so, yeah, if anybody wants to look up the Mount Vernon Monster, there's a, it's funny, there's not much out there. There was one article in the Washington Post from like May of 79, I think the article came out that I found, but it's fascinating time. So something in the USFL and then the Mount Vernon Monster.
You know, it's funny. Those are the things that scare the hell out of me. Like I would be scared. Why?
I don't know. Creepy, man. It was creepy. Middle of the night, these shrieks would come out of this forest, and I'm not going to give it away. But yeah, it was pretty creepy.
Yeah. I love the diversity of, I mean, you did the Donkey Kong, the high school football. And then there was one other one. I'm sorry. I'm escaping.
We did New York Doll, which is about a glam punk rock band, the New York Dolls back in the day.
Oh, it was the World War I pilot?
Yeah. Jerry's Last Mission. I'm very proud of that film.
Yeah, I thought that. I saw a clip of that. I think Scarlett was in that.
Well, she's in the sort of clip. So she, Scarlett Johansson knows, well, the guy's passed now, but it's kind of a complicated story. But Scarlett Johansson had a relative who had flown with with Jerry Yellen, who was the pilot we profiled.
And that was the one where his son married a Japanese woman?
Yeah. So Jerry Yellen was, he flew the last combat mission of World War II. They had already bombed Hiroshima, and he was strafing in Japan. And when he got back to the States, he was on Iwo Jima, which had 30,000 dead bodies on the beach. I mean, it was awful. So PTSD, contemplated suicide every day. And in the mid-80s, his son moved back to Japan and married the daughter of a surviving kamikaze pilot. And he was confronted with his enemy once again. It's a really incredible story.
It was powerful, the image of him playing with his grandkids on top of him, wrestling around. I don't know if you remember that photo.
Yeah.
But it's a good lesson. I mean, you know, a lot of, I don't want to get deep, but like hate or racism or just strong beliefs, you know, once you kind of, I don't know what the word is, but I think those things can get knocked down pretty quickly once you let yourself kind of just,
Jerry Yellen is an extraordinary example of that.
Yeah.
I mean, he had a deep, deep hatred for Japanese, a deep hatred. You know, you got to remember when Pearl Harbor was bombed, you know, it was like, it was an awful thing that people wanted to go hurt Japanese people. And he was a part of that. And then his son married a Japanese woman, and he had Japanese grandkids, and it totally melted him and totally changed his perspective of humanity, not just how he felt about Japanese, but of humanity.
Yeah, powerful story. Ed, enjoy. I think you're taking your son to the game tonight. Have a good night. Really appreciate you coming on. And, you know, I know we haven't talked in a long time, but I've always looked up to you and I'm really impressed with what you've done in your career. So thank you.
Thanks, Dirk. I appreciate you having me on.
All right, man. Thank you.